91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we revisit the restudy of the Florida Everglades, that is. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. What we call the restoration of the Glades is the biggest project of its kind in history. It's created the largest human-made wetland in the world. The Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan is nearly an $8 billion project to be implemented over decades, but it's been hampered by political and funding disputes. The Everglades is a World Heritage Site and an ecosystem which, in the words of the famed Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, is like no other. We'll hear from the top administrator of the project, Shannon Estenose, in minutes. First, NPR and regional news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Wednesday. And we have a great topic today.
We do. This hour, we get an update on Everglades restoration from the federal government's top project director. She's Shannon Estenose. She heads the Department of the Interior's Office of Everglades Restoration Initiatives.
Efforts to mimic the unique ecosystems, water flow, and habitats is a function of both federal and state governments. It's a massive project, which has been fought and debated for decades. Florida voters have supported the Everglades project at the polls, yet progress has been slow.
So we'll learn more about the big picture from Shannon Estenose, and welcome to you, and thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Joe. It's great to be here.
I guess this little mini rainy season we're going through now kind of helps.
Well, it does, and we've been suffering from a lack of rain over the last several months. It was a slow start to the rainy season, particularly down south. But this is a symptom that we have in the Everglades, right?
What's feast or famine.
Well,
what's the level at Lake Okeechobee now?
We're at just above 14 feet. Which is a pretty good outlook going into the dry season, although we were worried 2 months ago because the lake was pretty low. But it rose pretty quickly, 2 feet since July.
So. And, of course, the end of the system indicator would be Florida Bay. How are we doing there?
Yeah, we're in trouble in Florida Bay. We're very worried about Florida Bay. You know, one of the ways to think about the Everglades as a whole is that the Everglades is like a person with a very, very suppressed and weakened immune system because of all of the harm that we've imposed on it over the last 60 years. And because it doesn't have a strong immune system, because the ecosystem is weak, anytime Mother Nature dishes out something like a drought or a storm or a fire, for example, which are all natural occurrences, the ecosystem is less capable of withstanding that impact. So in Florida Bay, we've had two consecutive drier than average years, this one in particular. The bay is already weakened because it hasn't had flow from the Everglades for decades. And so now we're seeing conditions in the bay where it's a compounding effect. So you get the bay gets saltier because there's less fresh water. It starts to heat up. Seagrass starts to die, take oxygen out of the water, releases nutrients. More seagrass dies. Algae blooms start. And this can be, we saw this in the late 1980s. And when it happened in 1980s and it got out of control, the bay suffered damage that it didn't recover from for two decades.
We may have new residents here. Florida Bay, of course, is the very tip of the peninsula in the Caribbean Sea.
That's right. It's the very bottom of the terrestrial Everglades ecosystem, right under Everglades National Park. Most of it's part of Everglades National Park. Yeah.
I thought we would do even a little history because there may be some newcomers that don't even know the history of the Everglades. But before we go there, how will sea level rise, by the way, affect this situation?
Right. So sea level rise poses another stressor on the system.
Okay.
And once again, the healthier the ecosystem is, the more able it is to take Mother Nature has to dish out. The other thing about sea level rise is that, you know, one of our goals, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is to move more fresh water through the Everglades and out to the coast, particularly down south. And doing that can help us actually combat sea level rise. So it's sort of fighting salt water with fresh water. We're going to do a lot of that in Everglades National Park.
All right. So just to get this straight, before we get into all of this, you work for the Department of the Interior. It's a government agency.
That's right.
So Would you just break down for us the division of responsibilities between the state of Florida and the government, the Department of the Interior,
Federal government. Yeah. Sure. And this is one of the most confusing parts of Everglades restoration. The best way to think about it is that it's a 50-50 partnership almost across the board. So when you think about the fact that the federal government controls about manages about half the Everglades, the state manages the other half. The state of Florida is focused, you know, really has a lot of responsibility over water supply. The federal government is really tightly focused on flood protection. So there's sort of a, you know, there's all yin to the everybody to there's a yin and yang going on there. The Department of the Interior has stewardship responsibilities over the federal Everglades. So we run, you know, we are the National Park Service, we are the Fish and Wildlife Service, we are the U.S. Geological Survey, we are the Bureau of Indian Affairs. All four of those bureaus are working down here in Florida, in South Florida. So our responsibility is to take care of the land and the water resources that are part of the federal Everglades, and those include, for example, the National Park Units. We also have stewardship responsibility over threatened and endangered species. So the snail kite, the panther, the Cape Sable Seaside Sparrow, these are all threatened and endangered species in the Everglades. So I like to think of Interior almost representing kind of the client in this big Everglades restoration project. We are the beneficiary, our resources are. And then the agency that does most of the actual physical work is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And that's because they manage this massive flood protection system that we are trying to overhaul so that it does less damage to the Everglades.
This is the largest restoration project in world history. How do you sleep at night?
I don't know. The longer I do it.
You were just telling us about that insane figure that one of the water storage areas, holds enough water to put Miami under 7 feet of water.
Yeah.
And you were saying that the area we're talking about is twice the size of New Jersey.
So, yes. Yeah, so let me just throw out some numbers. Because one of our biggest challenges is helping to communicate, particularly to newcomers, the scale at which we're working, right? So they see the dollar figures for restoration projects and they think, wow, that's really expensive. But when you think about the scale at which we're working, so just one reservoir that's part of Everglades restoration, the one that's being built over there in Lee County around the Caloosahatchee River, that reservoir is going to be capable of holding enough water to put the city of Miami under 7.5 feet of water. The Central Everglades Planning Project, which takes water out of Lake Okeechobee and moves it south through the Everglades, that's going to move enough water to put 9 feet of water on top of the island of Manhattan. I mean, these are the massive. Some of the biggest construction in the region for the next decade is going to be associated with Everglades restoration. So huge, huge infrastructure work, but a massive investment in the future of the region, because we like to say in our little world, as goes the Everglades, so goes the region, because the infrastructure that we are modifying as part of Everglades restoration is our very water management system. So when you're driving down the road, you're conscious of the road infrastructure, right? But there's usually a canal running next to you.
Right.
And most of us drive right by that canal, we don't even see it. But the fact is those roads wouldn't exist but for those canals, because those canals provide flood protection. But that water management system has done tremendous damage, not just to the Everglades, but also to our tribal Native American tribal communities and their cultures. So we have a big task on our hands, but an important one.
So should we do a little history for newcomers, how this all began? Just a little history, the attempts to drain the Everglades, and when that started, and then the establishment of the Central and Southern Florida Flood Control Project, and what that did.
We could go back to Napoleon Bonaparte Broward.
Right. We were just saying.
Hence Broward County.
Yeah. We were just saying with Joe that there are many starting points, but I think we can in very quickly say that the 20th century, we can think of from the Everglades perspective, was the era of drainage. And this began really at the beginning of the 20th century, where efforts to develop the region quickly came into conflict with the nature of the landscape and the amount of water that was on the landscape. And if you could put yourself in the shoes of someone here in 1905 or 1910, it must have just seemed like just nothing but a flooded wasteland for as far as the eyes could see.
They couldn't fully
grasp the scale. And so initial attempts to drain the area were sort of always too small. They would try to drain a sort of sub-region of the area. And as those first initial decades progressed, we got to the 1930s where we built the beginning of the dike around Lake Okeechobee, because we realized, oh, I see, if we cut Lake Okeechobee off from the rest of the Everglades, not only do we get to treat it like a reservoir, but you prevent...
There's lots of real estate to sell.
Yes. And
the farm.
Well, that's right. And there, you know, there was a real objective was to build a burgeoning, vibrant urban, suburban, and agricultural economy. And the system, it took 40 years to build it. And it works like gangbusters.
It's a totally different mindset.
It was.
These were swamps. They weren't wetlands.
Well, that's right. And it's hard to impose, you know, what we know today on our predecessors, because they really had a different set of objectives. And you have to say, I'm a civil engineer by training, and you have to look at the system and sort of, from an engineering perspective, kind of marvel at it, because it really is one of the most efficient flood protection water management systems on the planet. When you think about how much rain this region gets and how often we really experience severe flooding, it's a pretty remarkable system. The problem is that it devastated the Everglades.
Right.
And what we've learned is that you cannot separate the health of the Everglades from the health of the economy in this region. They go hand in hand. So the era of restoration began, you can start it in a couple places, but we'll put it in the 1980s, the modern era of restoration. And then Governor Graham, for example, became a really early champion. And even in the 1980s, our view of what it took was a little too small. And it wasn't until the 1990s that we realized, holy cow, we have to refurbish the entire water management system in this area that's twice the size of New Jersey.
That's a great place to start, but
great.
We are kind of glossing over Marjorie Douglas. So
well.
Now let's return to 1985.
Okay. And that's the peril, right, of one of my own heroines, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. But yes, you're right. There have been many, many heroes. She is the mother, potentially, you know, arguably, of Everglades restoration. But in the 1980s and the 1990s, that's when we really got a handle on the scale at which we had to work to solve this problem. And, you know, so we began in 1992. We began, for example, with the Kissimmee River Restoration Project, which is a phenomenal, remarkable project that literally puts the wiggle back in the Kissimmee River, which used to be a wiggling, winding, slow-moving river. And we channelized it in the 1960s. We made it straight. That's right. And when we
brought back the birds.
Oh, my. And when we're done in 2019, it's 86% done. When we're done, we will have restored 44 miles of river and 40 square miles of floodplain, which is larger than the island of Manhattan. So...
Okay, lots of numbers, astronomical numbers here. We're trying to get our head around.
We're flying through this, and it's time for a break.
We're with Shannon Estenoz. She's director of the U.S. Department of the Interior Office of Everglades Restoration Initiatives. A short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation about Everglades restoration with Shannon Estenoz. Shannon, where are we now, basically? And we're behind schedule, of course, a little bit. Every project goes. But how much behind and why?
Okay, so I'm going to start on
where we are.
Right, where we are now. And let's start from the year 2000. I know this seems arbitrary, but the year 2000 is when the Congress authorized the biggest chunk of Everglades restoration. That was that big infrastructure water management refurbishment I was talking about. So we're 15 years in, and we are, I'm the first to admit, not where we had hoped we'd be in 2000. So that's sort of the bad news. But here's the good news. The next 10 years is going to move a heck of a lot faster than the first 10 years
Why?
Did. And the reason is, there's a couple of reasons, I think. First, we are smarter now than we were in the first 10 years. I mean, think about it. Everglades restoration, Joe, you said it. It's the largest effort of its type on the history of the planet. Nobody's ever done this before. Government was not really organized in a way to do something this big. We talked about all the intersecting jurisdictions between the
right.
state and the federal government, and it's working through all of those was harder maybe than we thought. The other thing is in the first 10 years, I feel like we got in our own way quite a bit. We created a lot of complicated process that we thought sounded good when we developed it.
Like, give us an example.
Well, our planning process, for example. I mean, in the first 10 years, it was taking us 6 and 7 years to plan a single restoration project. Well, we've learned that lesson, and I'm happy to report that the Central Everglades Planning Project, which is the largest chunk of restoration we have ever taken on by itself, because of the Corps of Engineers in the state of Florida.
Is that SERP?
SEP.
SEP.
The SEP.
Oh, okay.
In the dictionary of acronyms, it's SEP.
CEP.
The SERP is the comprehensive.
Okay.
Right. The SERP is the bigger plan. SEP is 6 SERP projects. Bundled together, $1.9 billion.
We have to watch our acronyms.
Yes, and I had pledged not to use them. So that Central Everglades plan, that bundle of 6 SERP projects, we planned that in 3 years. And the way we did that was the Corps of Engineers in the state of Florida, the Corps of Engineers used SEP as a part of its national pilot project to streamline its planning process. Now, it was a massive bite of the apple to try to streamline, but we did it. And one of the things that we did really well in that process is the other reason we're going to do better in the next 10 years. We allowed ourselves in the first 10 years, in my opinion, to get wrapped around the axle of difficult problems. And we were not efficient about working through those issues, solving them, and moving on quickly. And we've gotten a lot better at that. And our effort to plan SEP, we dedicated an unprecedented amount of resources to stakeholder engagement. We had 15 months of really intensive sitting down with recreation groups and environmentalists and agriculture and the tribes. And those folks spent a lot of time working with each other to work through a lot of their issues. And as a result, we ended up with a plan that has incredibly broad support. At the end of the day, SEP had the support of the environmental community, the sugar industry, and everybody in between. So it really paid off, and it showed that solving problems quickly and efficiently and addressing conflict early on is really important.
That's pretty amazing that everybody agreed on anything. Can we, because we mentioned this in the open, can we explain, if you know, because it's a state constitutional amendment that was passed, Amendment 1, in last November. So it was passed overwhelmingly, and yet nothing's happened. We were supposed to buy 47,000 acres, or the government, they were going to purchase 47,000 acres from the sugar industry for the Everglades. So that hasn't happened, correct?
Right. So there are a couple of issues there. There's the Amendment 1 issue, and sort of it's the legislature's job to interpret that language and then decide where that money's going to go. Money did come to the Everglades, I think, $75 million. I'm not exactly sure of that number, so nobody quote me. But it's part of the $126 million that went to the Water Management District to do Everglades restoration. So a chunk of Amendment 1 dollars did come to Everglades restoration. And, you know, I'm sure the debate about Amendment 1 will continue into the future. But that is certainly under the state's purview to implement that amendment. Now, you asked about the sugar purchase. Right, the state of Florida decided not to exercise its option
to buy the 47,000 acres.
Correct, from U.S. Sugar. And, you know, from Interior's perspective, you know, our hope, and our secretary did sort of talk about this on Earth Day when she was down here with President Obama. She did mention this. And, you know, our hope is that the state and the industry will work together to look for opportunities to bring more land into public ownership south of Lake Okeechobee. We understand that the state did not exercise this option. Okay. But everyone knows we need more water storage throughout the system. The University of Florida just issued a report last year that says we don't only just need it south of the lake, we need it east of the lake and west of the lake and north of the lake and in the lake. And everybody knows that. There's no credible Everglades expert that doesn't think we need more storage. So our hope is that the state will look for other opportunities to bring more land into public ownership, as needed.
If the state doesn't buy that land, it could wind up falling into the hands of
developers.
Well, I mean, that's always a risk, right?
And more water usage.
Yeah, it's always a risk when, that's why I use the word opportunity, is to really look for opportunities to purchase land that we know is in the right place. You know, if, you know, we've primarily used willing seller programs. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, U.S. Sugar wasn't a willing seller, you know, anymore. And so that became not an option that could be exercised from the state's perspective. So, you know, we hope that other opportunities will present themselves and the state and the industry will work together to take advantage of those opportunities.
Should we talk about water quality?
Sure.
Because that's, you say there are misconceptions about that.
Yeah.
Well, I know the phosphorus levels have gone down,
yes,
correct?
Yes, they have. They are going down in many parts of the Everglades. So let's talk a little bit about what we've done. So water quality, for those of you, your listeners who are new, when we talk about water quality, we are almost always talking about phosphorus. But we shouldn't forget that there are other water quality concerns, okay, in the Everglades, like mercury, for example.
Right.
But let's talk about phosphorus.
And pollution.
And pollution, right, exactly. But let's talk about phosphorus. So over the last 20 years, the state has made huge investments in big filter marshes to clean phosphorus out of the water before it goes into the central and southern Everglades. And the reason for that is that Everglades doesn't have a lot of phosphorus naturally, and even small amounts of phosphorus can change the landscape of the Everglades pretty significantly. So 57,000 acres of filter marsh have been constructed so far. They are now removing an estimated 84% of the phosphorus that otherwise would have come into the Everglades, which is very significant. 57,000 acres, by the way, just to give you more mind-boggling numbers, that's an area that's the size of the District of Columbia and the city of Hialeah combined. So just to give everybody a sense of how big these areas are. In 2013 alone, the year 2013, the water year, which was a very wet year, the existing filter marshes treated 1.16 million acre feet. Now, this is enough water to cover the city of Chicago in 8 feet of water. So I could, you know, I could go on forever with these big numbers, but I find it's important because folks can't usually comprehend what an acre foot is. So now the state is making, on top of all of those investments, the state is now making $880 million of new water quality investments, bringing on even additional filter marshes, 6,500 additional acres of filter marsh, and they're building additional storage to hold water before it filters into these filter marshes so that the filter marshes are more efficient. That was one of our big problems, was we were just dosing these filter marshes with big amounts of dirty water, and they were not being as efficient as they otherwise could be. So we're not only are we adding to our filter marsh footprint, but we're making them more efficient by building some storage to go.
What about the habitat in those marshes? Has it returned to a more original Everglades state?
Well, most of these are built on former agricultural lands. So,
but were originally part of the Everglades.
Were originally part of the Everglades, correct. And if you, I strongly advise folks to go out to some of these filter marshes are now some of the best birding areas in the world. They're also some of the best duck hunting areas in the country. And they're beautiful, beautiful, beautiful marshes. The thing about the Everglades is the ecosystem responds pretty quickly. When you get water flowing back through the system responds quickly. I should say, though, that the filter marshes are not meant to go back to natural Everglades. No, because what we're talking about is taking agricultural fields, converting them into filter marshes, which are beautiful marshes, but they're not supposed to be the natural Everglades. They are the buffer between agriculture and the natural Everglades.
But better than farms.
Well, certainly better for birds and better for water quality. That's
right. So just let me ask this, because you're talking about the health the health of the Everglades and that it can restore itself pretty quickly when it has the water. About a year ago, they were talking about that the alligators were dying, and you said that the alligators, when the alligators aren't doing well, something's gone wrong with the ecosystem. They're the canary in the coal mine.
Right.
So has anything changed in this year for the alligators or for the ecosystem?
You know, I haven't seen new alligator data, but it's hard to measure year by year. I think our scientists would tell us, you know, every year is a data point, but it's hard to tell a full story about what's happening in the system given a year, given the fact that we could have a dry year, we could have a wet year. I think we have a number of species and a number of ecological features that we call indicators. So alligators aren't crocodilians are not the only ones.
Right.
We have wading bird indicators that we watch them and we measure their populations, we measure their breeding behavior, and that tells us what's happening in the ecosystem. And you know, for example, we've got indicators in Florida Bay that are going to tell us something's really wrong in Florida Bay. And so we know that those indicators will start. We feel very confident because the Kissimmee River is teaching us this. We're almost done with the Kissimmee. And what we're seeing in the Kissimmee is once you start to put nature back,
it comes back quickly.
Really quickly. In the northern estuaries, the St. Lucie estuary and the Caloosahatchee estuary, for example, we pummel those estuaries with excess flood water every few years. So we'll get a really wet year like 2013. It's too much water on the landscape for our current infrastructure. So we start just releasing it out to the coast, throwing it away, throwing it out into the ocean, into the Gulf of Mexico. But in between the Everglades and the Gulf of Mexico are these beautiful estuaries, ecosystems that just get pummeled. And what we find is that the less frequently we do that, the more able those systems are to recover if we could just buy them time to recover. But right now, our infrastructure is not designed to buy them time. It's designed to hit them whenever we get too much rain.
Right.
We're speaking with Shannon Estenos. She's the Director of Everglades Restoration Initiatives, part of the Department of Interior. We'll take a short break on our program and be back with more.
B-Boy meets Gaucho as MDC Live Arts presents the U.S. debut of Combinado Argentino de Danza, a renegade collective of dancers and artists who juxtapose hip-hop, contemporary, and Argentine folklore to create a dynamic universe on stage. Saturday, October 17th at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. Tickets at mdclivearts.org.
I'm Tim Padgett. All this week, WLRN Miami Herald News presents a series of reports from Honduras on the Central American migrant crisis and how the U.S. is confronting it. The migration maze is made possible by MBAF, CPAs and advisors.
We're funded by WLRN members and by Fair to Remember, a full-service, off-premise catering company committed to making your event memorable anywhere in South Florida. Details on scheduling your event at 786-250-5387 and at affairtoremember.com.
Welcome back to Wednesday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we'll continue our conversation with Shannon Estenos. She's director of the U.S. Department of the Interior Office of Everglades Restoration Initiatives. And we'll open the phones now to you if you have a question about the state of the Everglades, the water quality, the wildlife. Are you an active member of the Everglades Coalition or another environmental group focused on the Everglades? If you'd like to weigh in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org.
I suspect we'll be getting lots of calls, so please make an effort to keep them brief.
Okay. All right, so where are we? What are your greatest hopes? What do you want to see?
Right, so where we are right now is we talked about how we got a slow start.
Right.
And we've learned some important lessons, and now we're moving much faster. And and that's great. We are going to celebrate, I'm happy to report, at least 5 groundbreakings this year alone, and we're going to cut ribbons on at least 4 completed projects this year as well. And some of these projects are really big. So, for example, we're going to break ground on or near Earth Day, hopefully, on the next bridge on Tamiami Trail. So we built a bridge on Tamiami Trail, 1-mile bridge, to allow water to flow under that road and into Everglades National Park down to the bay. We're authorized to do additional bridging by Congress, and now we're going to take the next bite and build a 2.6-mile bridge, so 2.5 times longer than the 1-mile bridge, and we'll be breaking ground on that. That's a partnership, really exciting partnership, with the state of Florida Department of Transportation. So we're actually engaging DOT to do what DOT does, which is to build a bridge for us that is really a restoration project. So as you drive over Tamiami Trail and you drive over what looks like transportation infrastructure, it's actually restoration infrastructure.
So right. For many years, the Tamiami Trail, yeah, and I suppose Alligator Alley, mm-hmm, was blocking a lot of the water flow that would naturally, of course, have occurred from the Lake Okeechobee area down to Florida Bay.
Right. So both Alligator Alley and, or which is I-75, and US 41, which is Tamiami Trail, they both run perpendicular to the flow of water. So water is literally trying to run, bump up against those roads. The difference between those two roads is that water is better able to get under I-75. That road is built up higher and it's culverted, but mainly the road is built up higher. So water levels don't threaten the base of that road. Tamiami Trail is an old road. It was built in the 1920s, designed for Model T's, I guess, or Model A's.
And, it was quite a construction project on its own.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, back in the day, during the wet season, that road, water used to flow over that road. They'd put a sign up on the Miami-Dade County sign that says, cannot cross, and there'd be frogs kind of jumping over this very wet road. Well, fast forward, modern traffic, big, heavy vehicles, you can't have water up and over a road like that with modern traffic. So it's been really important to raise that road, and actually now what we're doing is getting rid of whole sections of that road and replacing them with bridges so that we can raise that water level up and move it underneath it. Yeah, let the water flow.
Can we talk a little about fracking and oil drilling?
Sure.
Okay, so who would allow fracking in sensitive areas like in the Everglades? Would that be the state or
it's
the
more
federal
in Big
government?
Cyprus, I believe.
Right. So there's two kind of proposals going on. There's what's happening in Big Cyprus, which I believe has a fracking element, and I'm not as well versed on, frankly, on that project. And that certainly has a state permitting component. It will also have a federal component as well, and I'm afraid I can't talk too much about that because I'm not very well versed in what's going on there.
Okay, but the oil drilling.
Now there is an oil drilling. There's an exploratory well that is proposed in Broward County in the actual Everglades itself. This would be the part of the Everglades, if you can picture it, that's kind of up in Broward near I-75, really, Alligator Alley. That proposal we're watching very, very closely from an Everglades restoration perspective. Mm-hmm. I've reviewed that application. It appears to be part of a bigger proposed project. It very clearly says this is one part of a much bigger exploratory effort. So, you know, we're watching it very closely. We don't, you know, where the process is right now, my office is not engaged. We don't have a role. My office does not have a role in that process. It's with the state of Florida right now and the Corps of Engineers, I do know. So,
again, our number 1-800-743-9576. If you would like to join in the conversation with Shannon Estenose, she is the director of the Everglades Restoration Initiatives, Office of Everglades Restoration Initiatives in the Department of the Interior, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org.
Shannon, bring us up to date on efforts to control the non-native plants in the Everglades. And also for those listeners who aren't really familiar with this territory, why that is so difficult and so important.
Right. So we are second here in South Florida. Here in Florida, we are second only to the state of Hawaii when it comes to vulnerability to invasive exotic species. And there are a lot of reasons for that. We have big ports of entry for trade. We have very robust ornamental landscape industry. We have a very robust pet trade. And then we're in a part of the climate where a lot of critters find it pretty easy to live here. And so, and plants as well. So invasive exotic species is a huge threat to the Everglades. Absolutely huge. We could spend billions of dollars restoring the Everglades and we could still have an Everglades in trouble because of invasive exotic species. Pythons get all the attention, right? But they are just the tip of the spear. We actually have many, many, many more invasive species that we're worried about. And I will say this, the average general public, this is the issue where if you want to help the Everglades, okay, I think this is the issue where the general public can have the most impact. And there are basically just a few things that everybody could start doing tomorrow. First thing is to be a responsible pet owner. Never release any animal into the wild, into your neighborhood, and especially not into any body of water, the lake in your development, the canal, or the ocean. That's step number one. Step number two is to be a responsible homeowner. So not only do we encourage everybody to use native plants in their landscaping, but go out there and actively remove any exotics you have growing in your yard, because a lot of the stuff that ends up in the Everglades started in the suburbs or started in the urban core.
Okay, where can people get a list of what is exotic and invasive?
Okay, so here's what they should do. They should go to our website, which is evergladesrestoration.gov, and then under the program tab, follow invasive species, and we've got links to everything. So if you can no longer take care of your pet, for example, let's say it's an exotic pet, a reptile or a fish, there are programs that can help you find a home for it. If you release that animal into the wild, the chances are it's actually going to die. But if it does survive, then it could become part of a problematic invasion. So we want to really get folks to help us with that. And then finally, the other thing folks can do is they can expand their influence to their communities by looking for opportunities in their local parks to do removal projects. These are great service projects for exotic plants. If you've got exotic plants in a local park, for example, or on an easement, get out there and help us remove them. And that, you are helping the Everglades directly when you do that.
Give us an update on the stubborn Melaleuca and why it is so stubborn. You can't even burn them out.
Yeah, it's really difficult. But I'll tell you, Melaleuca's been kind of a success story. Although, you know, we're never, ever going to stop fighting the battle against Melaleuca. And this is the thing.
How was it brought in the first place?
Well, it was brought in a long time ago, decades ago, to help actually drain the Everglades. It is a thirsty plant from Australia. And folks actually got in airplanes and spread the seeds out to drain all the water from the Everglades, if you can imagine.
It's the tree that sort of looks like a pine and it has broken up bark.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
kind
like
of
papery,
a grayish paper.
And they're very, a lot of people are allergic to them as well.
Yes, I understand that that's true. So so once a species, plant or animal, gets established like Melaleuca, we are stuck with it. We can beat it back, we can get it under management control, but we will never stop spending money treating that species. So it's really important to act earlier, preventing invasions to begin with, and then if there is an invasion, let's say a lizard gets out, and we start seeing evidence of it, that it's breeding, we need to detect it early and rapidly respond, get it out of the system before it gets established.
So if somebody were to either release something or to know, I mean, is there a number to call?
So there are a number of resources. I strongly suggest they go to that website.
Okay.
Because there are several numbers that they can.
And again, the website is evergladesrestoration.gov.
Correct. To the program tab. And the program tab will take you to invasive species.
All right. We're going to take our last break. We have callers and we're going to get to you when we come back. We're speaking with Shannon Estenos, and she's the director of the Office of Everglades Restoration Initiatives for the Department of the Interior. Welcome back to Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're visiting with Shannon Estenos, Director of the U.S. Department of the Interior Office of Everglades Restoration Initiatives. We'll give the number out. We do have a caller there, a couple of calls. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or email radio@WLRN.org.
And let's take a first call. This is Tatiana in Plantation. Hey there. Tatiana.
Hi. I have a question. I understood that there was a sum of $75 million dedicated to buying land from sugar producers in Everglades. So what happened to this money? If I understood, sugar producers are not willing to sell their land.
Right. Hi, Tatiana. Thanks for the question. So the money that's come from Amendment 1 for the Everglades this year is going to be dedicated to mostly to construction of restoration projects. As we had mentioned before, the state made a decision not to exercise the land acquisition option on the U.S. sugar land south of
the
lake.
Can they go back on that? Can they decide to exercise that option?
I don't think so. I think it actually expired already or expires now or something. What I was saying from Interior's perspective is that, you know, we hope in the future that other opportunities present themselves and to bring land in that area into public ownership.
Okay, thanks for your call. Shannon, bring us up to date on the budget situation as we sit here now.
Yeah. So we've got the South Florida Water Management District. It got more than $126 million from the legislature. And so It's, as I said, putting a lot of that money to construction. And, you know, there's a real focus, I think, among all of us who work on Everglades restoration to turn dirt, just to get it. It goes back to this, gosh, you got such a slow start. There's a real sense of we need to build projects. We need to build because you can't manage water without projects. And then on the core side, actually, our work plan for 2016 on the core side is it's about 80% greater than it was last year. So and the reason for that is because we've got several projects that are teed up and ready to get rolling. So our 2016 budget that we're waiting to have approved, that's got a significant increase for the Corps of Engineers to do construction. So we're very excited about that.
Jay wants to know if the curly-tailed lizards threaten the Everglades.
Well, the curly-tailed lizards are exotic. I have several of them living in my yard. And I think their ecological impact, I'm not sure that their ecological impact has been thoroughly evaluated. You know, we have a large number, I want to say it's over 100 invasive reptiles that we know are in the Everglades. Most of those, their impact has on potential in the Everglades has not really been thoroughly evaluated. So, but curly tails are definitely exotic. And so, one of the many. We have brown basilisks. I don't know if anybody's seen those in their yard, but they run on two legs and they stand up and run very fast. We've got those in Broward County.
Oh.
And not to mention green iguanas,
right.
Which, of course, green iguanas, everyone, I think a lot of folks think those are native, but they're definitely not. They're invasive.
And Veranda wants to know, to what extent urban stormwater runoff adversely impacts the Everglades? To what extent would a robust green infrastructure in urban areas support water quality?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And, you know, there's one place still. It's called the S9 pump, and it's out on right off Griffin Road in Broward County, where you get urban stormwater being discharged directly into the Everglades. That's the way the system was designed. Nobody's, it's the way they designed it back in the day. And a lot of work has been done using water management to try to reduce the impacts of urban stormwater onto the Everglades. There's more work to be done there. There's a big restoration project we're building in Broward County to do an even better job. Certainly, green infrastructure, and that's another thing in terms of urban stormwater quality that homeowners can be a really big part of and really helpful is watching their use of fertilizer, applying fertilizers in the smartest way, which is not right before it rains, so all the fertilizer rushes off right into the water management system. Steps like that are tremendously important. And they're not just important for the Everglades, I should say. A lot of our urban areas, they drain out to the coast. And so our beaches, our coastal environments are really vulnerable to urban stormwater because our system is basically designed to take stormwater from the urban area and rush it out to the coast. There's only that one place where we're really pumping it kind of back into the Everglades. Most of it goes out to the coast.
Once again, Florida gets about 1,000 new residents per day.
Right.
So for those new residents, explain how the water system works here, the water table and the limestone and how we're sitting so close to our actual water.
Right, sure. So drinking water, the primary drinking water source for most residents, certainly in the Everglades ecosystem, is the Everglades. And the reason for that is that we have a very porous aquifer. Most of our drinking water comes from our underground aquifer. It's very porous, and it gets recharged by rain that falls on the system, and it falls in the Everglades. So, we control water in two major ways. We control it regionally. So we have these big canals. The biggest canals that you drive by are what we water geeks would call regional canals. And those are the canals that are controlling the levels in the Everglades. Those are the canals that might be delivering water from Lake Okeechobee. Big scale regional canals. Then there's the water management system in your city or in your town or in your neighborhood. Those small little ditches, the lakes in your communities. Those are all managing stormwater runoff and water supply in the urban area and the communities, exactly. So we manage water on two different scales. And when you turn your faucet on, though, and water comes out, it's essentially coming from the Everglades. So we've talked a lot about flood protection, right? But we can't forget that we have two seasons in Florida, a wet and a dry season, and we worry about flood protection in the wet season, but then we worry about water supply in the dry season when it stops raining. So all of that stuff comes from the Everglades.
I'm sure we have many listeners, say, in Western Broward. Tell us, so we can really understand, how it's pumping stations that allow us to live in development such as Weston.
Right. So those two water management systems that I talked about, the smaller scale one that is, we call secondary.
Did you have water management district board membership on your resume?
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. I learned a lot about this. And all of the pumping structures and the canals that you see, they're all there to do two things: provide flood protection when it's too wet, and to provide water supply when it's dry. And so as you're driving to work or to school, unless you are east of US 1, everything kind of west of US 1 is there because it used to be the Everglades.
And the coastal ridge.
Yeah, that's the sort of high ground. When you're standing, you know, around US 1, you're up on, you're in the nosebleed section, I guess, of the landscape. So all of those pumps, all of those canals are there to pull the water table down so that we can have houses and roads and schools. I live in the former Everglades. Most of us do.
David once is a new civil engineering graduate in South Florida, wants to know what your department is doing to promote local municipality to change current code to promote, not deter, low-impact designs.
You know, we, the department doesn't engage very much at that local level. Having said that, though, we are we do engage with the South Florida Climate Compact, which is looking at, that's that four-county compact, that partnership that the counties, that Palm Beach, Broward, Dade, and Monroe have gotten together to join forces and look for common solutions and approaches to sea level rise, the challenges of sea level rise. And I know as part of that, there are a lot of local governments that are looking at overhauling in, you know, secondary drainage infrastructure. And so to, you know, being plugged into that process is really as close as we get, you know, to water management at that level.
Trevor is asking what plans or projects are in place to combat sea level rise and the associated saltwater intrusion, which we talked about already.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that.
If you wanted to expand.
So the Central Everglades Planning Project that I talked about, that brings a lot of water that is currently sitting in Lake Okeechobee that we would otherwise dump out to the two coastal estuaries. That water, having it flow south through the Everglades and out the bottom through Everglades National Park, that's going to help us combat sea level rise down in the south. And then, you know, our closest partners are the Corps of Engineers and the South Florida Water Management District. And the South Florida Water Management District is responsible with the Corps for flood protection and water supply. And their challenge, and we respect this challenge because it's a great one, is to work with local governments to continue to provide the level of flood protection that folks have come to rely on, even in the face of this new challenge of sea level rise. And it's going to require a lot of investment. It's going to require a lot of engagement by the public and learn, you know, committing ourselves to learn what the challenge is and then be prepared for the investments that are coming in the future.
But the good news is that the restoration project is actually going to be very helpful in
that's right.
In, preventing, well, not preventing sea level rise, but in managing it.
Right, fighting salt water with fresh water.
Right.
And so right now, Everglades restoration is the biggest game in town when it comes to combating sea level rise, particularly in the southern part of the system.
What's the biggest challenge you have in your position?
I think the biggest challenge is helping folks understand the scale at which we're working. If it's probably been obvious in this hour that I've been talking, because restoration is going to take a long time, right? It's going to take several decades. And the dollars associated with it seem large, but they're not large when you consider both the stakes and what's at stake and the scale at which we're working. I think literally that is our biggest challenge.
And Joe, when we were talking before the show, I'll just say this quickly, he was talking about how people kind of just like, you know, give up on it because it's such a big thing and they've heard so much. And right. So how do we re-engage, get rid of this sense of ennui?
Yeah, that's a hard challenge. I mean, I think doing shows like this, reaching out to the public like this and helping folks understand how important this is, not just to the environment. It's not about the environment. It's about the region as a whole. As goes the Everglades, so goes the region.
That's, and the economy.
And the economy, that's right.
We've been speaking with Shannon Estinoz. She's director of the U.S. Department of the Interior Office of Everglades Restoration Initiatives. Their website, excuse me, for lots of information, evergladesrestoration.gov. Thank you so much for being with us and taking the time today.
It's been my pleasure.
And thanks for listening. Our producer, Richard Ive, technical direction by online producer, Paul Leary. If you'd like to pass the program on to a friend, simply download from our audio archives, WLRN.org, and check us out on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with Howard Simon, the executive director of ACLU Florida. It's the 50th anniversary of the Constitutional Rights Organization. Also, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining with Lure Seafood Bar South Beach chef John Iatrellis. One of our topics, oysters. Bonnie, how are you in oysters?
Allergic. Thanks anyway.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.